las 6:30 de la noche en la Law Auditorium de la Universidad de Boston. Si quieres ir, puedes mandar un email a mlsa.event@gmail.com. MIT Casino Rueda will be having a salsa workshop on this Sunday, March 1st. Lessons will be from noon to 2 p.m., and there will be social dancing from 2 to 3 p.m. It will be in Lobdell on the second floor of the MIT Student Center, Building W20. MIT Casino Rueda va a presentar un taller de salsa este domingo, el 1 de marzo. Las lecciones serán del mediodía hasta las 2 de la tarde. Y el baile social será de las 2 hasta las 3 de la tarde. Va a estar en Lobdell, en el primer piso de Student Center de MIT, edificio W20. And those are all the announcements we have, and I apologize for my mangled Spanish. Hopefully my Spanish will improve as Ferio continues.
Today is actually the first day that Mary has engineered the show. She just passed the on-the-air engineering test on Thursday, was it? Or on Sunday.
Sunday.
Yeah. So it's awesome. We're really excited about it. Okay, so we are the local voice of our hemisphere.
WMBR Cambridge. And you can always call us at 617-253-8810 if you have comments. And we always encourage you to call us during your show as well if you have stuff that you would like to let people know about.
And we'd like to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not representing the WMBR, the Broadcasting Corporation, or the MIT. So we'll be returning next Friday with another amazing guest, and we'll be talking about his work in over IAP.
He went to Asia, and he did projects involving like solar energy and stuff like that. So he's really, really cool. His name is Scott, and he'll be telling us about his projects. And he's started up his own company doing this stuff now, so he's really been successful. And it'll be exciting to hear about the work he's done.
So we have really exciting shows coming up. We hope that we'll see you guys again next Friday.
Yeah, and we'll put on some music right now.
Yeah, the last song that we'll be listening to is called Nazare Pereira, and I actually know who sang it this time. It's by now I can't say it. Okay, it's Clarero de Lua. So I will be returning to you guys next week. Bye.
O sol vive sem amor, eu não vivo sem te ver. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. O sol vive sem amor, eu não vivo sem te ver. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. O bugari dá o cheiro, o biriba dá o gosto. O clarão da lua cheia é pouco pro que eu te gosto. O clarão da lua cheia é pouco pro que eu te gosto. O sol vive sem amor, eu não vivo sem te ver. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. O sol vive sem amor, eu não vivo sem te ver. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. Quem chega na maré cheia é cantiga de bem querer. O bugari dá o cheiro, o biriba dá o
فمرحبا في Music for Human. I'm a doctor جالس السكران and I welcome you. I am fortunate to be joined today by Professor Levine, Professor of Judaism and Mysticism.
Nice to be here.
Welcome, Levine.
My pleasure.
And Levine, I believe you find, as I do, that we are besieged by many baleful spirits this evening.
That's right. Today was a meteorological singularity. The winds in the Boston area were frighteningly mighty and perhaps a little apocalyptic.
Yeah, they seem to impart some negative energy.
Yes, I was awoken several times by the fierce rattling of my windows.
It was oddly pleasant.
Pleasant, the way that sinking into an abyss can be pleasant.
It's odd how many times the source of danger or revulsion can actually yield pleasure in these ways.
That's right. It's the great paradox of evil, is that it draws us in. The darkness is strangely warm and welcoming.
Like Coca-Cola.
Yeah, that's also, well, probably best served cold. But as I felt the wind rattling my windows this morning, I felt myself, as I was perhaps still half asleep, I felt as if I was sinking into a deep, dark pit. And the feeling of total freefall in this pit can be a relief.
And seeing the eye of the abyss, it can certainly be very tempting to leap head first and see where one lands.
That's right.
Or if one were indeed to emerge floating gently in the belly of the planet.
That's right. Although in many mythologies and religions, the underworld is viewed as a scary place, It may not actually be so. It may actually be our true abode. The darkness.
The darkness. And that maybe is what our horror is that simply that we are from the darkness, and it is only by chance that we have emerged, and we are destined to return to the darkness, and hence we have a fear there, as we often fear the things that are good for us or the things that we love.
Yes, and of course fear itself is part of this abyss, that perhaps what's good for us will be to embrace fear. Embrace fear and anxiety.
And our subconscious does so. And so it is when we do not face the things we are afraid of that our subconscious is the motive force. It is the thinker, and it is the actor.
Right, and it punishes us for avoiding the fear.
It's something we should embrace.
Yes.
Have you had visions, Levine, of sinking into such an abyss?
Well, yes. As I said, I had one of these visions this morning, induced by the fierce winds in the Boston area. And often I find that natural phenomena can bring about these visions of the deep abyss of nature. I once, when pondering the power of the Niagara Falls, experienced a similar reverie.
The idea of it, one could simply be crushed or disappear and no longer exist, it's very real, and it's worth meditating upon these realities for several hours a day.
At the very least.
Yeah, it's a traditional Japanese method as well that one would... I'm not sure if our listeners or if you indeed, Levine, are familiar with the 19th century, I believe, or 18th century Japanese text, Hagakure.
Of course.
In which the samurai is advised to contemplate death constantly. Mm. As I do.
In your darkest moments.
Which is pretty much all the time.
Right, it's when we forget about death that we really separate ourselves from the harmonic being of the universe, from the whole. That individuality, in the end, is our downfall.
Yeah, I have contemplated death continuously since my wife passed.
And how long ago was that?
35 years. Yeah. She didn't die. She became a nun.
I see. And where is she now?
I'm not sure. As I said, I haven't actually heard from her for in excess of 30 years. And the nunnery is very secretive. So once someone becomes a part of the nunnery, then they are a nun. It's gone.
That's a very sad story.
Yeah, I don't feel too bad about it, but it makes me think about how... how things change. How one day you can be celebrating life, enjoying life. And the next day you can be outside of life, in a different life. well, we are fortunate to be joined by another person who has left life, who has changed his life. The unusual Rico Fito Bonbiron. Welcome, Dr. Bonbiron.
Hi, thank you. As usual, it's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Dr. Bonbiron, for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with his work, is an herpetologist, an herbalist, and an herbatonist.
Yes, yes, all of them.
Dr. Bonbiron, we were, Levine and I, and our listeners, mentally, were discussing the changes of life, the possibility of entering an abyss and returning to the darkness from whence we came. A subject that we, many months ago, discussed was the reality that we are all physically, quite literally, and also emotionally, simply tubes. We are hollow creatures.
Yes, this is very true. This is something we believe in herpetology. This is just an empty vessel that we travel in during our life, and that we hope that we can grow out of eventually to join a bigger vessel.
And yet we seek endlessly to fill ourselves with really no hope of doing so. We try to do this in vain. We eat, we consume other things, we are consumed, and we remain empty.
Yes, we are like the Russian dolls, one base inside the other, but without any ending.
So we are an infinite Russian doll.
Yes, we are. You know, Russian dolls all the way up.
And in the center, a laughing child.
Yes.
Well, our operator is indicating our first call. In general, if other people would like to call, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, welcome.
Yes, I would like to point out that the Russian doll is not only without end, but also without beginning. Perhaps you would toss that one around there in the circle of fires as we scoot around on the rock.
Thank you, caller.
For that pearl of wisdom. That. Yes.
I suppose in many ways we exist eternally. We are the imagination of ourselves. And in that sense, as an imagined thing, we are without beginning and without end. But once you remove the wrapping, the vision, are we merely an abyss, or is there really something more beneath this facade?
Well, for me, I believe that humans are, it's all a facade in a sense. We don't really live in the world. We have a model of it in our brains that works through the input of the eyes and the feelings of the skin. I mean, it's all whatever your brain interprets of the world. So in a way, everything is a facade.
That's interesting that you actually believe in the brain, because my understanding of it was that was basically a myth.
Well, I believe that, you know, this myth might have some, you know, I'm just being devil's advocate here.
But is there no way of freeing ourselves from this vision? Are we really relegated and forced to continue this imagined life?
Yes, yes, I do believe we are.
That's lame. Caller, welcome to the air.
Hello?
Hello. Marhaban.
Yes. Hello, this is Stanley Kubrick. I'm a movie producer.
Welcome, Stanley.
Thank you.
Stanley.
Yes.
Please stay with us. We can put a second caller on the line.
Well, thank you very much.
Caller two, welcome.
Thank you.
So, callers, what is your perspectives, generally, individually, and as a group, about being simply abysses?
Excuse me? Repeat?
Well, this was sort of what 2001 A Space Odyssey was about, if you sort of read between the lines, of just into space forever.
I'm sorry, we perhaps lost you for a moment there.
I have a question.
Caller two, please.
So.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sir.
Yes, your question.
My favorite food is watermelon. I'm serious. I'm obsessed.
And yet...
What does this mean to you?
Well, okay. Watermelon to me is particularly, out of all the foods, it does not even fill me temporarily. It seems to run right through my tube.
Well, yeah. I think it's usually more about feeling refreshed than full or satisfied.
So it's impossible to be satisfied by a watermelon.
No. Have you all ever tried blue paste?
Blue paste?
Yes, it's quite satisfying.
Is that like we call in some countries paste is glue? What is called glue here? Are you referring to a blue glue?
It's just a protein that's assimilated and manufactured in a robotic situation out in deep space.
Hmm. Is it? It's based on watermelon. Is that?
I'm talking saying? Watermelon, brothers. Watermelon from the ground. Real life watermelon.
Well, no watermelon. The rind.
I think you could get it in watermelon flavored blue paste. It's quite delicious. Quite satisfying.
And the blue paste is consumed by whom and for what purpose?
Well, you suck it out of tubes when you're traveling in, aeronautical spaceships.
That's beautiful. It's really symbolic.
I think so.
A tube sucking on another tube, and the one seeking to be filled, the other to be emptied.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like the image of the snake eating its tail.
You can go there too.
The snake in the classical Ouroboros image, of course, eating itself, consuming itself. But in this case, the food of one tube is the excrement of the other.
I think if you conceive of a snake excreting blue paste onto itself and then eating itself, you sort of get the whole picture of the yin and yang.
Well, I wonder if we abstract away from the particulars and we talk about this idea of human consumption and eating, and seems to go against our higher spiritual nature, this idea that we must consume and excrete. And I wonder if this is just, in many religions and theologies, this is just an aspect of humans' failure and their fall, that they must consume and excrete.
It sort of falls into a primitive input-output theory.
Baby, we all consume and excrete.
I believe we do, yes.
Well,
we
even,
all do.
Even plants and very simple
cows.
Microorganisms also consume and excrete.
And even if they're not consuming or are excreted, the only thing constant in this world is change. So by that definition, the world is consuming us little by little.
And excreting us.
Yes, it's like that famous painting by Goya, Saturn eating its kids. There's no end in sight. Time will eat us all eventually.
If we genetically modified our intestines, we could excrete blue paste.
Yes, I believe that would be possible.
Would it be possible to excrete bananas?
eventually. I don't see that's what the tree does, right?
And watermelon for our friend, the watermelon lover.
But, you know, I have to ask, what would you have to eat to excrete bananas? Because I know that there are proteins that the banana plant can manufacture from raw materials that we cannot process.
Probably other bananas, and you'll just get smaller bananas.
I think marinated monkey meat would do it because the monkey has a lot of banana protein in it.
Maybe so.
So ultimately, the banana must always come from another banana.
Friends, eat what bananas eat, and you will excrete what bananas excrete.
Is that the way how it works?
That's a simple
banana menu.
Well, I think we would probably need to splice in banana tree genes into our own genome to achieve that effect.
Absolutely, absolutely. This was the way to get it done.
And that is, again, something that one should not fear. I can imagine that the modern man is simply in his innocence, in his primatehood, may fear the possibility of excreting yellow-packaged white fruit.
Or finger bananas. I mean, it's possible.
Smaller you mean the actual phalanges would be replaced by...
Yes, eventually.
Embrace change.
And you will be able to have, instead of children, you'll have children that will be bananas.
Precisely. Well,
you could have both. You can have children that are bananas or children that are children. Or hybrids.
Well, I wonder if this whole question of consuming and excreting, this process, this universal process that we're a part of, I think this takes us back to our first question about the abyss, whether we can ever free ourselves from this cycle of consumption and excretion and truly just become abysmal beings.
I think only our grand bananas can do that. The bananas of our bananas.
Several generations down the line. But if we are really to reproduce in the traditional manner, we would expect to actually yield a banana primate hybrid, which is what we have become.
So that's what we call smoothies.
There's some sort of cannibalism.
Cannibalism, small animalism.
Well, you mentioned reproduction, Dr. Jalas, and I wonder if our reproductive powers are essentially tied in with our ability to consume and excrete, and whether if we lost one, then reproduction would no longer occur.
Certainly possible. Let's bring another caller into this. Caller 3, you are on the air.
Yes, I do not understand why the genetic modification would be necessary to secrete blue paste when this could be more easily and directly achieved in accordance with the economy of technology doctrine simply by changing the diet. For example, one can simply eat a couple of packages of Razzles and excrete a fun circus in your commode.
A veritable cornucopia of pastes.
Well, this is absolutely fundamental advanced research that this person is... The whole discussion has evolved to a new zenith.
Or some might say devolved, but one man's zenith is another man's... What's that word?
Abyss. Well, callers, and I think this all ties in also with Professor Levine's previous comment on the interrelationship of sexual reproduction and other changes. So, like, one may imagine that an immortal being would not reproduce.
But we hear all the time of this sexual reproduction, but what about bisexual reproduction, really now? Is this issue too taboo?
Or I know that some authors have discussed the possibility of reproduction from many like seven-part reproduction.
Isn't that how lesbian polar bears do it?
I'm not really familiar with the mating practices of lesbian polar bears.
I thought they were bisexual.
Well, I recall that a predecessor to this very program pioneered the issue of same-sex abortion some number of years ago.
Well, maybe you can enlighten us on how that conversation went.
Oh, it's in the archives. That's beyond the scope of my expertise.
Well, it's something that our interns will have to go through tonight. That well, most definitely.
Lesbian polar bears notwithstanding.
Well, thank you, gentlemen and gentle ladies, for your time.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for calling.
Meow.
Thank you for astounding astuteness.
But to continue along the lines that the caller brought up, the another point that that we might be interested in is the polyploid plants. Again, this ties into Dr. Bombiron's expertise. The idea that a single, for example, you know, many apple plants could be combined into a single apple.
Yes, the cross-fertilization happens very frequently. You see it all the time.
And the resulting fruit would be very large, very, very large tomatoes with small seeds.
I once studied Japanese methods of apple growth, and I found them quite interesting. So they would take an apple tree, and in its youth, they would knock off 90% of the apples from the tree, the ones that were viewed as inferior, and leave only the 10% that were superior, and then all the nutrients of the tree would go towards that small minority of superior apples, and they would grow to the size of large grapefruits, and they'd be packaged individually with cellophane and bows and sold at market for incredible prices.
Yes, yes, they even have this that they do with apples, that they bring and they cut the plant. I don't know how you say it in English, this technique where you remove a piece of the plant and you put another one from a different plant.
Grafting.
Yeah, yes, that's the word in English. And they graft an apple tree with several different apple trees. So they have one apple tree that has, you know, 20 or 30 varieties of different apples growing on it.
Hmm.
And it actually works as a beautiful, majestic new plant.
Let's bring another new voice into the discussion. Caller 5, welcome to the air.
Hi. I've heard that story about the apples, except in this story, the apples did not grow, as you say, to the size of a large grapefruit, but rather to the size, rather circularly defined, as a large apple. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, caller.
That is quite interesting. Some theologians actually believe that the apple in the Garden of Eden was actually grown by the Japanese in this style.
Or I've heard that it was a pear.
That's quite interesting.
And it's interesting, I think, the lack of specificity in these stories is unusual. I heard once a tale where a woman was describing how she was attacked by an ogre. And she took the time to mention that instead of having two eyes, it had a single eye in the middle of its forehead that was the size of a fruit, which I found very strange because she, you know, thank you very much, it's the size of a fruit, but which fruit?
Yes, it's something that has always been mind-boggling for me.
It's very vexing because it could be a raisin.
I have heard one theological interpretation of the Garden of Eden, that the fruit was actually grains of wheat.
Oh, astounding, astounding.
So how did the snake bring the wheat to Adam and Eve?
Well, he probably harvested it and made some bread out of it.
Or tortillas.
I think it's made from corn.
I've also heard that the Garden of Eden was actually, that the Lord actually grafted onto the tree human body parts, and they therefore grew. And these body parts were the apple, and eating of the fruit was putting the body parts together to make another human being.
So
God's rib.
Again, that the concept there is that originally our forebears were immortal, and that the price of reproduction is death. That you eventually have to leave and make room for your own progeny.
So, in a sense, Eve gave the biggest sacrifice of all. She gave her eternity to fill her abyss, her void, with somebody else by building from the plant another human. It's quite beautiful.
Seems like a big mistake.
And the Lord made Eve from Adam's rib.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that variation of the story.
Well, I know that in my studies, the word, the Hebrew word is tzela, which can mean side or rib. And in one mythological interpretation, it's believed that the original Adam was actually both man and woman joined at the side. And the creation of Eve was merely the separation into the dualistic parts.
Oh, so it was a Siamese at the beginning? They were Siamese? They decided to get separated?
Yes, man and woman was unified into one unisexual whole.
Wow, that's intriguing.
And of course, many view the ardors of passion as a quest to reunify this whole.
And yet, this is very interesting because we have these very diverse views. The one very common view is that our ancestors were in some original place, that some peak of perfection that we cannot return to. Another view is that, and the sacrifice there has been for some new conscience or ability that we have sacrificed perfection for. Another belief is that that we have sacrificed immortality for progeny. Another is that we have sacrificed we remain on a quest to reunite with some part of ourselves. And a final system is that we are empty and we seek to fill ourselves with whatever we can find.
Well, human sexuality is a lot like grafting, putting things onto other things, connecting things like tree parts.
Well, maybe this is why there's no peace in the world, why people always feel incomplete and alone. They have been, you know, we have to join together to become, as Adam and Eve were, one, and truly one. Maybe this is where it all went wrong.
Why do people smoke cigarettes after sex?
It's all in our effort to return to a single glorious whole.
I think the lit cigarette may represent the embers of universal consciousness.
Oh.
And in our feelings of disappointment after our attempt at reunification and its letdown, we need to light a small flame.
A symbol?
Perhaps, again, it simply represents our mastery over science, and that after having given into some base drive, we return to our mastery and remind ourselves that we are not animals. I wonder if in the pre-tobacco times it was typical to simply sit by a fire.
It's interesting. Your comment brings to mind two basic views on human mating and reproduction. The one views human sexuality as an attempt at reuniting with our ultimate selves, our unisexual universalism. And the other view views it as a human failing, a human weakness and frailty. And according to the second view, the ultimate human sacrifice would be to abstain from all passion and to devote oneself to quietness of the soul in perhaps a monastery or a nunnery, as your wife has done.
Yeah, the path of my wife was very unusual to me, and unusual also, but perhaps it's a side issue. Let's bring in another voice.
Hello?
Caller six.
Hello.
Caller six, welcome.
Hey, I was calling in. I was listening earlier, and you guys were talking about the internet and how kids can get injured by having too much social networking. So I just wanted to talk about my experiences with my son, my teenage son. He's 14 years old, and he's addicted to internet porn. And I was wondering if you had any advice for what to do with that.
Well, you can probably just move the laptop to a common room. That will probably be the biggest impact on your son.
Okay, the problem is it's already, I mean, it's in our bedroom. It's in my wife and I's bedroom. And, you know, I'll wake up in the morning and he'll be there and he'll be, you know, doing his business right in front of us. And the thing is, the desk is right next to my side of the bed, so I can see everything he's doing.
Well, it's...
Caller,
he really likes it.
Are you familiar with the quite ancient practices of weaning the child? Weaning involves the practice of the mother, in order to prevent her child from continuing to breastfeed into a very late age,
okay.
She would apply a bitter substance to her nipples. Hence, when the child, puts his mouth forward for the sweet milk of the mother, he would instead receive a strange and unwelcome taste. And I suggest the application of an analogous method for your child.
What my wife did in that situation was, when our son was going through the exact same problem, she would tase him.
Well, that will probably, you know, work at weaning people off.
It's a little harsh. I stop at spanking. The thing about weaning is, I was breastfed until I was 12 years old, and my immune system, I've never gotten sick in my entire life, and I've never had any cysts, ovarian, prostate cysts.
Do you still miss it, or was it something you gave up voluntarily, or were you win?
That's the idea, is that, you know, you get breastfed until you give it up. And when I was 12, I woke up one morning, and I went to high school, and I said to myself, you know what, I'm not going to be breastfed anymore. And, you know, my mom was cool with it. My dad had left a while ago, probably because of that. So,
well, our son is quite normal now because of the...
After having been tased?
The tasing. But he still does breastfeed, but...
It's hard to give it up, you know?
Bonds the family together. It brings us together.
Yeah. You know, I saw there's a new kind of a sex toy that's actually it's like a blow up doll, except there's a milk sack, and you just suck at the milk sack, and then it makes moaning noises and says oh yeah.
His boyfriend actually...
Oh no, please don't do that.
His boyfriend actually wears that as a prosthetic device, and
yeah. There's a piece you can take off and put onto your lover, and that's the breast.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd recommend soy milk, though, because it, you know, it doesn't stain as much.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I use chocolate soy milk. Chocolate silk. And I go wild. I just get it all over my face. Great.
And all of these discussions are very interesting, because it all brings us back to this idea of filling ourselves, this idea that we felt happiness at a young age, and it makes one wonder what new age dating would be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think mostly it's you know, trying not to fill that empty void with words and with food and with alcohol and drugs, and really just going all out for the penis.
Well, so I personally believe that there are 10 commandments of love for New Age love and dating.
It's a very Jewish take, I think.
Yes, these are the commandments of Yahweh. The first commandment is to stay connected through word and deed. The second commandment...
Talmud?
Well, no, this is from several 20th century New Age gurus that I've studied under.
Okay.
So, stay connected through word and deed.
Do they wear yarmulkes these days, or hats, or little mini beanies? I don't know what the proper term is.
Yeah, yarmulke is a commonly accepted term. And yes, many religious Orthodox Jews still don the yarmulke as a sign of their fear of the Almighty.
Yeah, it's scary.
The Almighty is quite frightening.
I don't go outside sometimes. Scary stuff. Yeah, Almighty, you know.
And he's a vengeful God, so yes.
What's he going to do to you next? Is he going to, you know, kill your children? And that's kind of what makes life exciting.
We connected our menorah to a taser.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you want to do to wean your kid off Judaism.
I'm sure that will work.
Oh, you know, that's actually a great idea. I should put electroshocks on my son's penis. Have you guys tried that? A shock collar?
No, I don't have a child yet of my own. I stick to plants. They're easier to control.
Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, apparently there's this thing going around where they're Taiwanese prostitute rings where you can get women for very cheap. I was thinking of renting one for a couple years for my son. Just so he'd have somewhere to, you know, do his business. And then after that, you know, so, you know, free her maybe or whatever it is.
Well, we can't condone this sort of thing on the air, but...
But also, I'd ask the caller to consider how he would have his son develop his powers of love.
Yeah. Which is the most important thing.
I have to go. It's been great. I love you guys.
Well, thank you, caller.
Nice. We love you too.
Now, one of this reminds me of the tenth of the Ten Commandments of love is to integrate the purity of spiritual love with the passion of physical love and the power of emotional love. So it's three kinds of love: spiritual, physical, and emotional, which should be integrated.
And I believe if you're missing just one of them, you can't really connect with the person. I mean, if you only have the physical, it might be great, but how long does that last? If you only have the spiritual, but then there will be tension in the bedroom.
It's like a plant trying to grow without nitrogen.
Yes, or without sun or without soil. How will it grow? How will it sprout?
I think plants are absolutely not to be trusted.
I think there is a lot to be said for that perspective. Which is, I think, why vegetarianism is so popular among, you know, forward-thinking people. The idea that that we animals should band together and eat the tomatoes.
Well, if God hadn't wanted plants, he wouldn't have invented cement.
Let's bring another flame into the fire. Caller 8, welcome.
Hello.
Marhaban.
Hi there. Could you explain something to me? Could you tell me the difference between spiritual and emotional love? Because as far as I can see it, spiritual is just a more intense form of emotional love, you know?
I believe, if I may answer for Professor Levine, that emotional love is quite obviously connecting to someone on an emotional level, that is connecting to them in a way that is based on happiness and sadness and other emotions and a feeling of love that goes beyond lust, whereas spiritual love is really connecting to them on a spiritual plane with belief systems and a really rational understanding of one person to another.
See, and I actually believe that one can experience spiritual love with a person without even knowing that they exist. It's really, it's at a level above our consciousness that we may, our spirits may be intertwined with someone who we've never met, we haven't met yet.
And the spirit can be connected with other galaxies, other dimensions, interstellar things, things we don't even know we're experiencing.
Yes, I think it's what physicists call entanglement between two bodies and galaxies far away.
Exactly, exactly.
But I think this is what lends so much credence to this idea that we were all connected at one point and that we seek to reconnect. It's this idea that there is this emptiness.
Well, my therapist told me that when I was bringing baggage to or in a relationship, that it maybe the baggage I was bringing could have been a black hole or a comet or an interstellar device.
That's interesting. So you may have been spiritually entangled with an extraterrestrial being.
And you just can't tell because the spirit is so flowing and free moving that, you know, why judge it?
No, you shouldn't. You should feed it so it can grow and live.
Or scare it. I mean, return it to this primal thing. But always face these things.
Well, I try to entangle my partner with it and wrap her in the ecstasy of these things. And sometimes it's cool and sometimes it just bombs entirely, like I'm sleeping on the couch.
Well, that relates to the ninth commandment among the Ten Commandments of love, which is do not be a jerk.
And, you know, I think going for the extremes that you're going is what keeps the relationship, you know, spicy. If you don't sleep in the couch sometimes, it's because you're doing it wrong. You should feel good that you're sleeping in the couch. It means that you're adventurous and you're taking, you know, you're going for the whole thing.
Well, I've got the best video games out here.
Well, that's certainly a positive view of really what is traditionally a fairly negative thing. But I believe, again, it's funny you should mention video games because I really regard them as a positive spiritual thing as well, that they are gateways to a spiritual dimension that perhaps we don't understand fully.
That's it's interesting because I actually have a small startup company and we're trying to develop a meditation video game that can actually help. The different levels of the game correspond to the levels of the heavenly realms.
Isn't that what Super Mario Brothers is about?
It might be. Certainly there are recurring themes. But in playing those games, I haven't actually used them, but does one enjoy spiritual development and enlightenment? Does the game incorporate the impressions of a person's life?
Well, I thought it did. I felt like my life was going pretty well when I was winning. So going on to one level after another.
You were able to identify nicely with the game.
Climbing higher and falling and dropping and getting back up and going again and getting little things and losing little things. And it seemed like a good way to live my life, just play that game.
Yes,
everything seemed to be going well.
I believe that we can pick out two very simple video games as metaphors for life. On the one hand, we can look at Minesweeper, and the other hand, Tetris.
And these are really radically different perspectives on life, and they correspond to different strategies toward life.
Right, in Tetris, it's all about fitting things together in your life. It's all about integration. Whereas in Minesweeper, it's about avoiding pitfalls.
Controlling the difficulties that you
That's
face,
right.
Identifying them, isolating them, eliminating them.
Exactly.
Could it be, Doctor, that those pieces are actually chakras?
It's an interesting perspective.
Yes,
Very few simple parts that combine to form very complex structures.
And the interesting thing is that when the new complex structures are formed, they immediately vanish, right? They immediately become one with the universe. They reach a stage of nirvana and spiritual enlightenment.
And they cease to become part of the problem and become part of an understanding. Thank you, callers. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of the hour.
Thank you, my esteemed guru.
My salama, favorite callers.
I shall make a movie about this.
And of course, thank you once again to Dr. Bombiron.
It's always a pleasure. I hope to be here again next Friday.
And thanks to Professor Levine.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human Beings on Fridays at 7 p.m. on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Night Owl. Ma'a salama.
For safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
If you have difficulty seeing words on a page, that's no reason to stop reading. Talking Books is a free program from the Library of Congress. When you subscribe, the Talking Books and a special cassette player will be delivered to you for free. As soon as you finish one, simply mail it back. The program and the postage are free. Call toll-free 1-888-657-READ. That's 1-888-657-7323. A message from the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped.